Live from the high desert of Prescott Valley, Arizona, this is the Progressive Technology Hour, and I'm your host, Bill Alec. Just to give you a little background about myself, I'm a degreed electrical engineer, and I currently do software consulting work for major corporations. That describes my day job. At night, I become Dr. Houdini, researcher, explorer, and experimenter in the world of exotic technologies. What are exotic technologies? Well, this includes such areas as free energy, gravity, anti-gravity control, the study of the nature of time and time travel. We'll explore not only the technology, but also the how-to part of the technology. So let's have some fun today and explore the world of exotic technologies. Folks, my special guest this week is Greg Mihalik. Greg specializes in advanced space propulsion concepts for interstellar travel. As a member of AIAA Nuclear and Future Flight Propulsion Technical Committee and as a chair of the Future Flight Sessions at the Joint Propulsion Conferences, Mr. Mihalik will guide us through some very exotic propulsion possibilities. He will refer to a set of presentation slides during the show, which he used at a recent AIAA Los Angeles luncheon. So please click on the link, which can be found on Achieve Radio's website listed on today's show. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's a pleasure to be your guest.
Greg, a couple of weeks ago, I spent a full hour talking about a fascinating subject of mine, faster than light travel, and how it might be possible by applying a torque field to the craft, causing Einstein's special relativity speed limitation to shift either left or right, dependent upon the direction of curvature of the applied torque field. What are some of the ideas you may have about faster than light travel?
Well, there are quite a few concepts out there about faster than light travel. There's actually probably a good dozen or so. And the presentation that I put together for the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics just kind of hit some of the highlights of very few of those so that the audience was able to get just a real top-level understanding of some of the concepts that are out there. One of the first ideas that I covered in the talk is something called the Alcubierre warp drive, and I don't know if have you heard of that, or are you familiar with it?
Yes, I have.
Okay, it basically does something. It sounds like what you had mentioned in the show you did is something similar to what this particular warp field would be, so to speak, where there is a very strong positive gravity well applied in front of a craft, and a very strong an equal magnitude negative gravity well applied behind the craft, and then the craft just kind of, you know, rides this gravity wave through space-time. There are a number of concerns about that, however, in the fact that it opens up another Pandora's box of, well, what is gravity, and how fast does gravity propagate through space-time? If that warp type of warping is possible, which maybe this the torque field that was that you addressed in your last show may apply to in some ways by torquing space-time so that you basically push it down and behind the vehicle and pull it up from, or push it down in front of the vehicle and pull it up from behind the vehicle. It sounds like the same type of thing, but I'm not too familiar with what you had mentioned. But if the speed of gravity only travels at the speed of light through space-time, then that limitation is only going to, that, you know, then your craft is only going to move at the speed of light. But nonetheless, there's a lot of other camps out there that that are trying to decide what gravity is and how fast it, you know, is it instantaneous? Does it obey some other form of some other law that says that it has to go faster than the speed of light, but not instantaneous, or is it the speed of light? You know, no one really knows yet on how to quantify that or how to go test that. So the other downside, or one of the other downsides about Alcubierre's drive, for as elegant of a solution as it is that you would need enormous quantities of what are called negative energy or negative matter in order to create the gravitational repulsion that you need behind the vehicle. And it's on the orders of like many millions of suns of negative matter kind of thing to make that kind of a distortion. So, you know, there's certainly concerns about how you would do that and, you know, how you would make the negative energy and so forth. But there's also a few different variants on the Alcubi air drive where a gentleman has come up with bringing in string theory and brain theory to the Alcubi air concept to say, well, if you compactify dimensions in front of a craft and you expand dimensions behind a craft, in effect changing their own little local cosmological constants, then you can effectively get the same type of space-time warping that the Alcubi air metric supports without the use of or the need for negative energy. But then again, you know, where are these dimensions? How big are they? You know, are we going to be really screwing up somebody else's universe if we go and try to compactify their dimension? So, you know, there's all sorts of issues behind that. But nonetheless, you know, on paper and in theory, it looks just as promising as the original Alcubi air drive. Go ahead.
No, I'm just agreeing. Agreeing.
Okay. There's some other concepts that are dealing with faster than light travel that I cover in that same talk. And again, these are just a few of many. but these are the ones that a technical community that I've been a part of for about 12 years now has been pursuing on a number of levels. And they're even at the experimental stage right now to see if some of the physics or baselines are possible to test some of these ideas.
Yeah, I do have a question here.
Okay.
Are there any experiments going on to test higher dimensions? Are you aware of? Or?
Not that I know of. The only ones that I think that, you know, I think what the cosmological folks and the quantum physics folks and the string theory folks have realized, and those three disciplines I just mentioned are all interrelated, although they don't know it yet. You know, the quantum physics folks don't talk to the cosmology folks, even though they're dealing with the same type of phenomenon at different scales. But all that aside, the new collider coming out, the Large Hadron Collider, is capable or theoretically capable of probing energy levels within space-time that no other device has been able to probe. And the reason why I mention that is because the people that are the folks that have come up with these D-brain theories and string theories and extra dimensions and so forth have all pretty much come to the same conclusion that these extra dimensions, whatever they are wrapped up in a very, very, very small space, you know, comparatively speaking, like 10 to the minus 32 meters sort of things, you know, the Planck length type of scales. And in order to probe those types of energies, or to probe those types of scales, you need enormous energy levels. And so I don't know if I don't think the Large Hadron Collider is going to get close to probing Planck length, but it will certainly get down to probing, you know, the makeup of possibly quarks and so forth, where we're getting, you know, extremely subatomic, and trying to look at the next realm of nature beyond that. So. Those are the only experiments I know of, and I don't know if there's any dedicated to specifically look for extra dimensions, because how would we know? You know, when we find one, how will we know it's there? You know, it's it comes back to that, too, designing the experiment so that you know what you're looking for. And that's also a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Good question.
Don't they think that gravity crosses these dimensions?
Yes. The one particular theory that I mention in the talk that I focus more on, because it's actually a pretty elegant theory, and it actually, you know, the faster than light travel was sort of an offshoot of what the primary basis of the theory is, but it's called the tri-space universe and the tri-space model of the universe. And in this particular model, the tri-space, meaning, you know, that title says that implies that there are three different spaces, and that's sort of what this Bohr type of model, you know, like Bohr's model of the atom, that's sort of what this model is of the universe, where in one space-time, there's you and I, the Earth, our galaxy, every observable mass that we can see, made up of something called tardion particles, which is a vast family of particles. And you know, there's you'll hear tachyons, and I'm going to mention that in a second. But you can't make a tachyon particle. You have to make a specific kind of tachyon particle. A tachyon is a family just like tardions are family. And a tardion basically means slower than light in Greek. So, okay. You know, everything we see, all the natural phenomenon that we deal with is in subluminal space-time. Everything is traveling less than the speed of light and, you know, has real energy, real mass, etc. Mm-hmm. The second part of this tri-space, and I'll address your question in just a second about the gravity, is what's called luminal space-time. And this is where photons and radio energy and electromagnetic energy and all of those types of entities exist that only travel at the speed of light, no slower, no faster, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that, you know, we can observe that realm. You know, we turn on a light, we see it. You know, we're pretty well understood of the characteristics of light and its wave-particle duality. And so we have an observational, platform to look down or to be interacting with this luminal space, with our subluminal space. Well, the third type of space is derived from the mathematics of special relativity, and it's called superluminal space. And this is where everybody throws their hands up in the air and says, well, you can't go faster than the speed of light, and that's absolutely true in this space-time. the superluminal space, is where these tachyon particles exist, and the mathematics can show that they basically have real mass, just like you and I, mm-hmm. but their rest mass, their proper mass, when slowed down to their slowest velocity, becomes imaginary.
Okay.
In this case, in superluminal space, their rest state is the speed of light. So they have to slow down this to the speed of light in order to incur special relativity effects. Whereas in subluminal space, like you and I, we have to speed up or accelerate to the speed of light.
Okay.
So in the same comparison as the faster we go, the more energy we need and so forth to get closer to the light speed regime, in superluminal space, these tachyon particles that have real mass have to slow down and put energy into themselves to slow down, which is very backwards to what our minds are used to, in order mm-hmm. to achieve these special relativity properties. But
okay.
The nice thing about superluminal space is that the lower energy you have, the less energy that a particle has, the faster it goes with an asymptotic velocity approaching infinity.
Okay.
So there is no, you know, the more energy you can take out, the faster you go with no limit. But the slower you go, the more energy you have to put in, which like I said before, is completely backwards. Now, again, I'm going to address your question in just a second, but I needed to put that background out there. if we think of this from a model that I'm sure we've all seen, where you see a grid and you see a ball on the grid and it makes a dent and you see, you know, that's the typical, you know, cartoon-like model of Einstein, you know, regular Minkowski space gravity. You've seen that before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the ball makes a dent inside the grid and something,
right.
you know, comes and rolls up to it. Well, that's
yes.
basically our view of subluminal space, and we're, you know, the dent is being made in this this luminal space plane. Well, the superluminal space part of this comes from looking underneath that sheet, and so you see a dent, or not a dent, but you see a bulge in this space-time that you were looking at from the other side, but you don't see any associated mass that creates this bulge. So the point being, and this goes back to your question, is that gravity is actually the communication mechanism between superluminal and subluminal space.
Mm-hmm.
And whether superluminal space can be considered another dimension or an extra plane of existence, you know, that all can be debated. But nonetheless, the characteristics of this superluminal space are starting to be put together, and the communication between these two spaces is gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So as for gravity acting on different other hyperspaces or alternate dimensions that others have proposed, that is certainly a condition where, you know, some even propose that our gravity exists because of the existence of these other dimensions.
Okay.
So, you know, there's some other, you know, more complex models than what I was just telling you about, but, you know, this one seems, the tri-space one seems to be a relatively easy portion to understand because it's very visual. It's a very, you know, you can wrap your mind around it to some degree as far as what it's trying to represent.
Okay, so you can say that gravity, the origin of gravity, could be from higher dimensions.
That's what some people think, yes. That's what some people think. For the tri-space model, that's not the case. But, you know, in the tri-space model, gravity is simply a distortion and displacement by a mass of the space-time continuum.
Okay.
Okay, much like a boat sitting on a lake, you know, where it displaces the water, you know, or actually I've had the example used as a memory foam mattress where, you know, you put your hand in it and it, you know, your hand, you know, you can see the mattress kind of curve in towards your hand. But as soon as you remove your hand, that curvature is still there, but you have a perfect imprint of your hand as well.
Okay.
And so in the tri-space model of gravity, it's a distortion and a displacement by mass energy that creates gravitational mass and inertial mass, which in this particular model are two different things.
Right.
So that's sort of where gravity comes from with this particular model of the universe. So going back to faster than light, the faster than light travel aspect of the tri-space model is that if real mass can exist in both spaces, basically, it has to be in one or the other because of the spaces coexist in the same space, you know, the same three dimensions. It's just a matter of crossing from one boundary of physical laws into another. But if mass can be converted from superluminal from subluminal to superluminal, then just by the nature of going into this superluminal space, traveling at the speed of light is perfectly natural, perfectly normal, and won't incur any special relativity effects. The other interesting thing about that is that in superluminal space, as you would be traveling through this space, you would be able to navigate, which is something that not many people have considered whenever they come up with these new warp drive or space-time bending concepts, is navigation. Is, you know, how do you move around in this alternate dimension or alternate space that they come up with? But in superluminal space, it's a little bit easier because every mass that exists in subluminal space, planets, stars, galaxies, whatever, makes a gravitational bulge or a gravitational signature in superluminal space.
Okay.
And so one can navigate perfectly normally, you know, if they know how to find those particular bulges. But this also brings into something, this brings something else into the wide-reaching applications of this model is, and I'm going to ask you this question. What is it that astronomers think they see when they see a gravitational effect with no associated mass?
Interesting.
And you know what the answer is? Dark matter.
Okay.
Yeah. So this particular tri-space theory, this tri-space model, lends one possible explanation or approach to the existence of what dark matter really is. It very well could be mass existing in superluminal space that's having a gravitational influence on our space.
So in other words, you can't really see the mass.
That's right.
But it leaves this imprint.
That's right. It has a gravitational signature.
Okay. Are you familiar with the work of John Hutchison and the Hutchison effect?
Very little bit. There's a few people I know that are more experimentalists that are familiar with his work than I am.
Okay, I had him on the show a few weeks ago, and he mentioned something very interesting to me, and that is during his experiments, he would apply his field, and the object that he was applying his field to would vanish from sight.
Interesting.
Now, maybe there's, some evidence here of higher dimensions, you know, that the object is being transported or transformed.
Yeah, that very well could be. As I said, I don't know very much about what his experiments contain, but just from what you explained, it sounds sort of like what they were trying to do back in the 1940s with the Philadelphia experiment. Where they were trying to cloak a ship using electromagnetic fields.
Right.
And they had all sorts of, you know, unusual after effects when they tried this on a very large all-metal battleship. But it supposedly, you know, disappeared from sight and came back, and then everybody that was on board had all these strange things going on. But nonetheless, it sounds very, very familiar to that. And the other thing that that could be, and I guess it could be, you know, it could be two things. And this comes back to the what I had mentioned before about there are many camps about what gravity is, trying to figure out what gravity is. There are one of those camps, and there's four groups of people. One of those groups of people believes that, and there's quite a few in this group, that gravity can be controlled by electromagnetic fields in some way. And, you know, the gravity and space-time can be manipulated to the point where, I should say, space-time, which contains all the electromagnetic radiation, can be manipulated to the point where you can create a gravitational effect. And that's sort of what goes along with that whole Alcubierre warp drive that I had mentioned earlier, is you would need some kind of specially conditioned electromagnetic radiation, which is a term from a colleague of mine, in order to create these types of fields. But if, you know, and there really isn't any direct evidence yet that you can control or create gravity using electromagnetism, although many, many, many people have tried and have put patents out saying that, yes, you can, and here's my idea, and here's why. But yet again, we don't have any direct influence of that. So if the Hutchinson effect was dealing with electromagnetic fields, and he did have some sort of success with doing this particular manipulation of space-time with his fields, then very well the object may have disappeared into some other, you know, may have crossed the gravitational barrier into you know, maybe superluminal space. Or in the case of being able to just, you know, bend light to the point where something looks like it's invisible using electromagnetic fields, and we all know that light energy is influenced by electric fields and magnetic fields, then, which is I think where they were trying to go in the 40s with the Philadelphia experiment. Then that's another option too, where that the object is still where it is, it's just, you know, the light is bending around it to the point where you can't see it.
Right.
So, you know, two possible explanations, and again, I'm not educated enough to speak any more on his work.
Well, there might be a way of getting there. I don't know if you ever heard of the work of Dr. Miles, Professor Miles. Yeah, he's a professor from there's a university in Germany, and he demonstrated a really neat experiment last year at the Tesla Tech Conference, which was held in Salt Lake City. And I saw this demonstration. It was rather amazing. He was able to transmit power through the air using this Tesla wireless power transmission system.
Oh, okay.
And he powered a little plexiglass boat around a little pool.
Hmm.
And he was just transmitting about 20 watts of electricity using Tesla's apparatus. And what I thought was really interesting, though, is that the resonator he was using, okay, to transmit this power, used Tesla's spiral transformer.
Okay.
Tesla patented a series of spiral transformers.
Yeah, I'm somewhat familiar with Tesla's work, but not that particular one.
Right, and Miles wrote a book about this, and he's saying that Tesla's transmitters used what they call these scalar waves, these longitudinal electromagnetic waves. It's a longitudinal wave. And the way that you get this wave is using these spiral transformers. They're wound in a spiral direction.
Okay.
And it creates an asymmetric magnetic field. And that asymmetry between north and south, that asymmetry is where this longitudinal component emerges.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, yeah. And we may be able to harness that longitudinal component, okay, to create these powerful electromagnetic, these torque fields.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about them in some of my research, because I tend to think that gravity is a torque, and it's related to perhaps a torsional component or this longitudinal component of a electromagnetic wave.
Yeah, and was it Jeff Amenko that's also supporting that same theory with torsion fields?
I'm not really familiar with his work.
Okay, yeah, I'm just somewhat familiar with it just from hearing other people talking about it. But I believe that there is some Russian folks, one of which I don't know if they're in Russia or if they just are Russian by heritage. But a gentleman by the name of, I believe it's Jefimenko or Krasnikov, or there's a few other Russian names, and I kind of get them confused of who's doing what. But one of them was a proponent of what are called spin fields, which in the which other researchers have called torsion fields, where you basically have like a vortex in space-time, and gravity vortex.
Mm-hmm.
A very close colleague of mine that I just met with at this conference last week has published a few papers on these as well. And saying that there's I guess a particular type of pulsar that has recently been discovered where they believe that there is maybe there's a gravitational vortex at the center of this binary pulsar system because of the strange signals and the strange time offsets and things like that they're seeing from this pulsar.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but it's But there is a, I think Einstein even said that, spinning masses create some sort of torsional torque, so to speak, in space-time, which is what the whole frame dragging concept came from. So that's perfectly viable.
Okay. You brought up something, frame dragging.
Yes.
Has that been experimentally proven, or?
Well, it's actually funny you bring that up. There's Gravity Probe B, which you may know about.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Which was sent up to identify if frame dragging actually existed around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They also, there was also a lot of predictions about what frame dragging could be based on Einstein's equations and all the other people that were involved with making the equations. And Gravity Probe B was sent up, and it was comprised of four gyroscopes, very, very highly sensitive gyroscopes, superconducting rotating spheres, to try to measure over the course of a year any difference in precession of these gyroscopes that would lead to that would imply that there was some form of drag acting on these gyroscopes to change their precession rates.
Uh-huh.
And what they found was that there was, what I believe they found, and I don't think they've made their data fully public yet. They were supposed to do so, I believe, back in December. And I could be wrong about that, so please don't hold me to that. But the last I checked, and there's a reason why I had to check, is what they found is there was an anomalous, spurious set of signals that was orders of magnitude beyond what they were hoping to find as far as frame dragging goes, that was interfering with these gyroscopes. Okay. Now, they weren't sure exactly what it was, and they because the Gravity Probe B experiments have decades of history behind their design.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was actually on the drawing boards back in like the early 60s or something like that, but they didn't have the materials and they didn't have the technology to do this. But they, the technology became more available with superconductors and computing capability, they were able to finally design the satellite and launch it. So I mean, this goes back a long ways, the history of this experiment and what they were hoping to find. And what they came back with was something that was, very different than what they were expecting.
Really?
And they thought that maybe there was some effects that they hadn't considered, that 40 years of the top physicists in the field haven't considered, that were affecting these gyroscopes.
Okay.
Okay. So keeping all that in mind, we're going to shift gears to a gentleman by the name of Martin Tymar at the Austrian Research Centers in Austria. What he has done, and I know Martin personally, and I haven't seen his work directly in Austria, but he freely presents this work with published downloadable papers from many different sources. What Martin Tymar did was he devised an experiment to search for the supposedly missing mass when two electrons get together to form a Cooper pair in a superconductor.
Okay.
And what that means is that these electrons interact with each other in such a way in a superconducting material, which is, at very, very cold temperatures, mm-hmm. that allows the superconductor to generate, you know, this unusual magnetic field and hold current indefinitely and so forth.
Right.
But the way that this the way that what happens is, you think if you took a mass of an electron and a mass of an electron and you put them together, you're going to have some sort of binding energy that gets released, and so your overall mass is actually going to be a little less.
Okay.
Okay, than the two electrons independently.
Right.
Well, what the theory had said is in some other I think some other experiments had said prior to his work, is that when you put these electrons together, you actually have more mass than the two independently.
Really?
So what Martin did was put together an experiment to try to come up with a way to find out, where is this additional mass coming from? Is it being stolen from a different energy source or a different source within the atom, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so he basically put a ring, in a superconducting niobium ring inside of a holder, and he got this ring isolated mechanically and, you know, completely isolated from any electromagnetic fields and mechanical influences and thermal influences and structural. And he submerged this ring into liquid helium to get it to superconduct, and he rotated this ring. And I don't recall right now how he designed this experiment to look for what he was looking for, meaning, like, I don't know why he decided to rotate the ring and so forth, but nonetheless, what his sensors found was that when he would spin the ring in clockwise direction, the sensors thought they were spinning counterclockwise. They were reacting to some force at a distance that was like a torque.
Right.
And these sensors, and he used both accelerometers and gyroscopes, and even got a hold of a Russian military grade gyroscope.
Uh-huh.
And he is seeing this particular torque force reacting that is 30 orders of magnitude greater than what Einstein was predicting would happen when you initiate when you would have frame dragging.
Okay.
So essentially what this is all boiling down to is what Martin was seeing in his superconductor experiments is well above and beyond what any modern theory in physics can try to explain.
Right.
And this is the stuff that's going on right now. I mean, as we speak, he sent me a paper 2 weeks ago and said, I'm going to be publishing this or presenting this in at a conference in Amsterdam. Here's the pre-published paper.
Okay.
But he has many, many papers and is willing to talk to anybody about this.
Okay. Okay, Greg?
Yes.
Okay, now you mentioned just briefly that there was a torque and then an opposing torque.
What do you mean?
You touched briefly on the effect.
When he was spinning it one way and the sensors were thinking they were spinning the other.
Yeah. What's that? Can you elaborate on that? Or?
Yeah, that essentially was what was supposedly frame dragging, was that as the ring is spinning through space-time,
yes,
space-time is reacting on the spinning of the ring by providing a drag on the ring, which is being picked up by these sensors.
Okay.
And so initially they were thought to be those sensors were thought to be picking up frame dragging.
Right.
But they were so above and beyond the theory's predictions that it said, well, this is frame dragging, but it's so above and beyond what the theory and the magnitudes are predicting that we don't know what is causing this now.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
and now just to elaborate a little bit more, these sensors were completely 100% isolated from the spinning ring. They were at various distances from the ring, above the ring, to the side of the ring, within the ring. And Martin is known in Europe and is even becoming known in the United States for his rigorous, thorough experimental techniques and his openness to receive, you know, any kind of criticism or encouragement or some stuff to look at. He's gone back and redesigned his experiment 3 or 4 times, different apparatus, slightly different setup, but enough to get the same results.
Okay.
And even more so. Every time he redesigns his experiments, the fidelity of his results gets bigger and gets better and better and better. And again, there's no modern theory. There's no theory in modern physics that can readily explain this.
Okay. Okay. Have you heard of the Wallace-Morgan experiments?
No.
There's some papers on my website. If you go to the library, there's the Wallace Morgan experiments written about several people here. Now, this experiment was really interesting because what Wallace did is that he took a disc and connected it mechanically to a motor, okay, and spun this disc. Now, next to the disc, he placed another disc that was freewheeling, okay? It wasn't connected to the other disc at all. Now, when he brought it up to speed, the other disc began to spin, okay? The freewheeling disc began to spin in the opposite direction.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds very similar to what Martin Timar's results are seeing.
Yeah. Could that be some sort of an inertial reaction of space?
It very well might be. That's what people are thinking right now. And
yeah, there's an action and then there's a reaction
of
space just in the opposite direction.
Yes.
Because you wouldn't expect that disc to spin in the opposite direction.
Yeah, that's right. And that's kind of what his sensors are saying, you know, is that, you know, he spins ring clockwise and the accelerometers think that they're spinning counterclockwise.
Exactly.
Okay, now, somebody tried to reproduce this experiment down in New Zealand. And keep in mind, Martin Timar is in Austria, northern hemisphere. New Zealand, southern hemisphere. It's the largest ring laser gyro in the world. It's like meters on a side, okay? And the University of Canterbury in New Zealand put together a very rudimentary experiment to try to replicate Dr. Timar's work. They used a lead disc instead of a superconducting disc.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, Martin spent years putting this experiment together, making sure that every possible sensitivity was characterized. And the guys in New Zealand spent like a few weeks. Okay. So the fidelity of the hardware was vastly different.
Okay.
What the New Zealand folks found is that it was the opposite down there. When they would spin it clockwise, the sensors would think it was spinning clockwise.
Really?
And so now there's a hemisphere effect, you know, so people aren't, you know, how does that come into play?
Coriolis, perhaps.
Yeah, so is there some influence of the Earth's gravitational frame dragging on this little local experiment? But all the way back to what I was telling you about the Gravity Probe B experiment, which was in orbit about the Earth, the type of experiment or the type of results that Martin Timar was seeing in his work are of the same order of magnitude and the same types of results or the same types of signatures that the Gravity Probe B folks are seeing with their multiple superconducting rotating gyroscopes.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the connections could be that Gravity Probe B is seeing the same type of effect that Martin Timar was seeing, or Martin Timar is characterized or starting to characterize, which was so above and beyond, you know, what the Earth's frame dragging effect is, because these were such local, you know, more concentrated phenomenon that it was overshadowing what it was supposed to be picking up from the Earth.
Okay.
So, but it's interesting that's, you know, and Martin Timar has talked to the Gravity Probe B folks at Stanford a few times, you know, in order to help them try to, assess their data and figure out, you know, what their signatures are actually telling them. But, like I said, Martin has, you know, he's continuing to do his experiments. But if this is something truly real and truly truly unexplainable right now, or can be explained later but doesn't match any theory, this is by all means a Nobel Prize type of, you know, paradigm shifting sort of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would basically be able to create an artificial gravity field. And if you can do that, then that's, you know, who knows, there's many, many things that can happen once,
right.
once you create that kind of technology, even at the most fundamental level.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, Greg, I have it's an email here, email question.
Okay.
From JJ in Northern California. He has two questions. Are there any possibilities for faster than light communication? For example, is there a way to pipe an electromagnetic wave around Einsteinian space for interstellar radio?
That's the first question.
Yeah, that's the first question. The second question, do these concepts get around the SR time contraction? Can we vacation on Tau Ceti for a week and get back in the same century?
Well, that's actually, yeah, that's actually the title of the talk that I put on the AIAA talk is Advanced Space Propulsion for Interstellar Travel.
Okay.
And, you know, the points that I make in the earlier part of the talk are, you know, we got to be able to do this within, you know, it'd be nice to really go to another star and come back within 15 years. I mean, not 15 years from now, just saying, like, if we take off in 2010, we go to another star, we fool around there for a while, and we come back by 2025. So 15-year round trip. Mm-hmm. All right, because that's, you know, that would be, you know, that way the astronauts could come back and still have time to process their data and, you know, not be ancient, you know what I mean? But to address JJ's first question is, there have been experiments, especially over in Germany, and I think the professor's last name is Nimptz, N-I-M-T-Z. And he has been on a few shows, I think like Nova and I think one or two other shows in this country, where he's actually, he claims to have transmitted information in the form of music at about 20 times the speed of light in his laboratory. No one, I don't think, has ever been able to replicate that work or has tried to replicate the work, but nonetheless, there is some claim that information has been experimentally transferred, and this is done by, you know, this was done at a university in Germany, so it wasn't, you know, someone building something in their garage and so forth. So it's, you know, but that's something that that JJ can maybe go look up if he has the interest. As far as what's going on in the United States, I don't think so. But as far as experimental work goes. However, speaking from a theoretical standpoint, if this superluminal space does truly exist, then there may be a way to send information, you know, faster than the speed of light through superluminal space, so that we can see it or have some sort of, you know, signature of it in subluminal space. And I don't know how that would work yet. You know, so essentially, you know, whether or not we can send it faster than the speed of light, I don't know, because of just the nature of an electromagnetic wave where it's only one and only speed in space is the speed of light. Mm-hmm. The second question I believe he had was, you know, is it possible to go and visit these, visit Tau Ceti for a week and then come back and without right. violating the special relativity time dilation. And that's absolutely true, especially in this tri-space model. The faster you go in superluminal space, the further away you get from the light speed limitations where special relativity comes into play, and the more normal, I should say, or, you know, if that's the right word, the more normal you become, just like us, you know, in subluminal space. You know, when we travel at, you know, even when we travel at like Mach 0.8 in an airliner, we are so far, far below the speed of light that relativity effects don't really come into play, although they can be very, very carefully measured. One of the fastest space probes to ever leave the galaxy, which is, or not leave the galaxy, but to be launched by mankind, moving at 57,000 miles per hour, is still a minute, tiny thousandth of a fraction of the speed of light. And,
right.
You know, it's not, you know, you really don't incur any effects from those, you know, from even velocities that high. So the further away you get from the speed of light, you know, the less chance you'll be affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
And in superluminal space, the faster you go, then the less likely you'll have to have any sort of time dilation. Now,
okay.
with the time dilation thing, and this goes to relativity in general, there's the common conception that, oh, if you travel faster than the speed of light, you know, time goes backwards, your length becomes, you know, infinitely small, your mass becomes infinitely large, and so forth and so on. Well, one thing to keep in mind for all that, number one, is that is all from an observer's point of view. That is not from the reference frame of the actual vessel that is moving. Okay, to them, everything is normal. It's the observer that you're passing by that sees everything happening very differently.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that all of those comments and all of those, not comments, but all of those treatises are most likely true if you only tried to do that from subluminal space. So it's not like, you know, if we were to accelerate to 99.99 the speed of light on a spaceship and then turn on the big thruster and kick us over, you know, or try to kick us over the speed of light barrier, we would probably have all these unusual effects occur. You know what I mean? Or something odd would happen, or the observers would see these relativity effects and time travel and paradoxes and all that start coming into play. But we pretty much know that that's not possible to do, to get up to accelerate to the speed of light and then take that next step and just go over it. The transpace method of faster than light travel, which is what the part of the trispace model is that you basically start off with zero relative velocity and you simply jump over into this other universe or this other space where traveling at the speed of light is perfectly normal. The energy level at which you transfer over is going to dictate what speed you originate at in the other space. And so, you say you're traveling at, 60 miles an hour in your car, and then all of a sudden you transfer over into superluminal space, you could be traveling at, 150 times the speed of light. And I'm just making that number up. I haven't calculated it. And you travel at 150 times the speed of light, and then all of a sudden you want to come back, and you just, you change back, and you jump back into subluminal space. And now you're in a completely different location. You've not incurred any special relativity effects because you've not violated any special relativity at all. You've never gotten close to the speed of light, and so no relativity effects have come into play. Time, there's no reason why time wouldn't proceed forward in either of the spaces as well. So, all that seems to come into play, on a positive way, as opposed to like a QBR system where there's all sorts of analysis going on, is what happens at the nodes where the gravity goes from positive to negative on the side of the air, on the side of the craft, where you have this null point. You know, is what happens to time and space in there. And it's, there's all sorts of other concerns with many of these other methods of faster than light travel. But way too long of an answer for the gentleman's question. But thank you for the question.
Okay, Greg, I have another question here from Alex. He's asking, what is your opinion? Why NASA stopped the Breakthrough Propulsion Physics program in 2002?
I actually know Mark, and I've known Mark ever since he started the program. Mark Millis is the gentleman that was the founder and the administrator for that program for the 6 years that it was in existence. And I know him on a personal level, and I'm familiar with the work that he's done and have seen many papers by him, and so that's a very good question. One of the reasons is that, he had a very shoestring budget to begin with, because NASA was more concerned with, space exploration of planets and the Earth and Moon and, stuff like that, thinking way, way, way beyond, 50 to 75 years beyond our current level of technology isn't really their genre of expertise. They want to make sure that, the shuttle gets up safely and that we have the technology or ways to approach new technology so that we could send different robotic missions to the outer planets and so forth, and ultimately human habitation in our solar system. Mm-hmm. So the Breakthrough Propulsion Physics program came about because there were a lot of people sending in a lot of papers to many different conferences that were all, I'm just going to use the term loosely, like garage-built, guys with no formal background claiming that they've, for example, like sent a signal faster than the speed of light, or, crushed a pop can because they created some sort of artificial gravity field. But no one was able to reproduce their work. No one was able to contact them. No one was able to, get any more information or have the experiment verified in front of their eyes, for people that had credibility to review this information. And so one of the things that Mark had done was to put together a very thorough review process of these papers to try to weed out the crackpots from the real science, okay? Mm-hmm. And his criteria is actually very well structured and has actually proved very fruitful by allowing certain papers and certain information to come to fruition and be examined by the peers that have the education to do so. Like physicists and so forth, and other propulsion folks in the community, myself and my other colleagues. So his process worked out very well. There was also a website developed that's really good. It's called Warp Drive When, And Mark has also been on numerous science shows talking about some of these some of the work that he's done in the program. One of the other things that came out of the Breakthrough Propulsion Physics was the funding at a very small level for about 9 experiments to go and, on a very fundamental physics research perspective, go examine certain things that have always been questions, like about the Casimir effect or about quantum tunneling, or you know, a variety of other ones that each one of these experiments only got maybe like a few tens of thousands of dollars to go do, but they were being done at a university level or academia level by people that were, you know, established in the field, formally educated, had the equipment, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And majority of them produced null results or no results, and a few of them remained open for further experimentation. But of course, as most things happen in NASA, the funding got diverted from his program to go support other things that were nearer and dearer to, you know, the administration's heart. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, it got canceled at that point in 2002. But Mark was the only person working in that program. I believe at one time he had an assistant that was helping him with this. And, you know, I don't know how long that lasted or the duration of that, but Mark was the sole proprietor of that program and had to review literally thousands and thousands of different ideas and papers and try to, you know, categorize them as to, you know, what seems like it could be viable and who can I talk to, you know, who can I go find out if it is viable and what ones aren't viable. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was a tremendously stressful job for him as far as being able to have that, you know, be constantly on as far as knowledge like that. But it proved to be a very worthy program. And like I said, he's still very much involved in the advanced space propulsion community, even though the formal program is defunct.
Mm-hmm.
So who
picked up the program then?
Nobody. No, it's completely nobody? Defunct.
Okay. Now, what about STAFE?
The STAFE conference. The STAFE conference has been going on for 25 years, and last year was its last year, the 25th year. And the gentleman that was running the conference each and every year of those 25 years finally, I basically just said, "I'm finished. I'm retiring, and I'm done."
Okay.
And
okay, Greg, that. You know, I'd like to thank you for coming on board here. Fascinating discussion. You know, we're going to have to do this again.
Yes, absolutely. I'd love to.
A lot of material to cover here.
Yes, there is. And I thank your guests for their questions.
Okay. Okay, that's Greg Mihalik talking about faster than light travel. Fascinating subject.
And also, okay. if anybody was able to download that presentation, my email address is on the front, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions directly.
Okay, very good.
So,
thank you, Greg.
Thank you very much for having me as your guest, Bill. It was a great pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Coming up next is Michael Elejan. He talks with cosmic beings. That's next. I'd like to say a few words today about Extraordinary Technology Magazine, the official magazine of Tesla Tech Incorporated. In the October, November, December issue of 2007, featured articles includes The Rise of the Machines, It's Happening Today, Metal Storm, Tesla's Crackpotism, Stubblefield, The German Approach to Quantum Mechanics and Anti-Gravity, The Reif-Bahr Frequency Instrument, Why Double-Digit Inflation of Healthcare Costs. This magazine is available for purchase online from Steve Elswick and Terry Brady at teslatech.info. That's teslatech.info. Hey everybody, this is James Martinez from the Cashflow Show. I want to ask you one question and one question only. You're ready to change your life. Now, as you begin to think about that question, how many of you are swimming in credit card debt, tired of your credit cards controlling your life, behind on your payments, struggling to make ends meet, worried about your financial well-being? You're going to end that now. Enough is enough. This is hot. Are you ready to feel good? Now? That's right.
call our 800 number and listen to the 12-minute overview. It explains who we are and what we do to end your credit card debt. Leave your name and number after the message and do it today. Call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655. Freedom is a phone call away. Away. A way for you to feel good now. 888-213-7655. 888-213-7655.
Hello, everyone. This is Bill Alec, and I'd like to say a few words today about Health Galleria. That's Health Galleria, which can be found at channelforthemasters.com. Health Galleria sells many fine products, including books and DVDs that channel the masters. KM Botanical. Now, this stuff I've been taking myself. They also sell Qi Balls, Eculite, Far Infrared Sauna, Portable Tankless Oxygen, Himalayan Pink Salt Mill Grinders, Qi Exerciser, and many other fine products that can be found at Health Galleria under channelforthemasters.com. That's Health Galleria.